snowing and the temperature is 12. That's a news update from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Perry Vanelli.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Landfer. Whoever becomes president has already lost a third of his key transition time in the post-election wrangling over chads and manual recounts. What's at stake? Well, it isn't just the cabinet members who have to get into place. Nearly 7,300 jobs, many of them requiring FBI background checks, have to be filled to get a new administration rolling. How do you lay a firm foundation in less time? We're going to talk about that this morning with Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. He joins us by phone. Professor Berry, thanks for coming on this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why don't we start out by simply sketching briefly how the two sides are each preparing for their transition? And why don't we start with the Bush side?
Well, the Bush side does have a transition team in place headed by Vice President-elect, or so it seems, Vice President-elect.
Yeah, what do we say there? That says a lot about the transition
Cheney,
right there.
Cheney, who's a good person to direct it since he was a White House chief of staff and has a lot of Washington experience. And he has a staff, and they're in place. They're ensconced in an office building in Virginia. And what they're doing now is they're largely devoting themselves to personnel questions. There's two sides to the transition. One is personnel, the other is policy. But I think right now they're probably consumed with personnel, given the late start that they have.
Okay. And what do you see the Gore side doing?
Praying. I really don't think there's much of an active transition effort going on by the Gore campaign. They certainly haven't exhibited one. It would, I think, strike a false note and be seen as bravado, and I don't think they want to convey that. There's some thought been given. There are people who were ready in place to go to a more definitive transition effort if there's a turnaround, but I don't think there's much going on.
Okay, and I know that the Bush transition team came up with a slogan yesterday, Bringing America Together. Why do you need a slogan for a transition?
You don't. It's the first time I've ever heard or at least remembered a transition team slogan, so I think it's symbolic of the times more than anything else.
All right. And what do you think of the way each of them is handling their transition? Are they striking the right tone? I would assume that tone is more important in this transition than in previous ones.
Well, I think that, given the uncertainty of the election, that both campaigns have actually done pretty well. I think some of their supporters have been very strident and charging, and I think particularly on the Republican side, of using some very excessive rhetoric about stealing the election and so on. But I think the campaigns themselves have been temperate. And George Bush struck a very, very conciliatory note last night on 60 Minutes, too, where he didn't pressure Vice President Gore to drop out. He really doesn't have to at this point, I don't think. But I think he tried to be true to his words of being a uniter and not a divider.
You talked about how a transition involves both personnel and policy.
Right.
Which is more important?
Well, they're both important.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately policy is more important, because that's the enduring change that and that's what affects us. But personnel is the vehicle to get a lot of that accomplished, and it's not easy to accomplish. So, but you have to start with personnel, I think, in terms of getting the government ready to go. And so I think that's the appropriate focus at this point.
All right, but which is more affected by a shortened transition time?
I think that that policy is going to be delayed more than personnel. Will have there'll be a delay in secondary appointments in personnel than there otherwise would be, and the focus on policy is going to have to be delayed until you have enough people in place to make the decisions. You have to have the assistant secretaries and the deputy assistant secretaries and the agency heads, not just the cabinet members, to move forward on policy. So that's where the delay comes from.
How will this transition be different from previous ones?
Aside from the obvious that it's been truncated, the biggest difference is the Congress and the fact that the Congress is absolutely divided right down the middle makes policymaking very, very difficult. Most presidents, presidential candidates, as they anticipate coming into office, have a vision of what their first 100 days are going to be. They have a honeymoon period. It's a chance where they have the undivided attention of the country, and the opposition is usually weakened and sort of quiet for a while. And this makes that period very problematic because the Democrats are angry and frustrated, and you have a situation in the Senate where it's not clear who's in charge. So getting some policy proposals through that kind of situation is very, very difficult. And so I think that's really a bigger problem than the fact that they've lost a month in appointing personnel.
Now, I remember reading, getting back to personnel for a moment, I mean, 7,300 jobs, oof, that's a lot.
It is a lot. Not all of those are particularly important. Some of those 7,300 are appointments to commissions and so on, and the earth is not going to stop rotating if there's a delay in those. About 3,000 of them are what I would say are important positions, and those are, you know, go far beyond the cabinet and sub-cabinet positions. That is a lot of people. And what's more is that 600 of them have to go through the Senate. So that means a vetting process that has to be very, very detailed and to create a personnel system, you know, from scratch that can look at that many people, have them vetted, and push them forward and get them through the Senate, that is, you know, that's the equivalent of a major company,
right.
You know, in corporate terms. And you have to create this major company from scratch very quickly, get it up running, and it has to be effective because the administration doesn't want to be embarrassed by a John Tower, somebody that they appoint who seems like he's just going to go right through, and all of a sudden, you know, there's accusations in terms of alcoholism and womanizing and so on. So you can't do it too fast because you shoot yourself in the foot. So it's a problem.
Now, as we all know, when you mentioned these Senate confirmations, they're taking longer and longer with each administration. I believe with the Clinton administration, it took something like 8 months for a typical appointee to get approved by the Senate. So there are some commentators who are speculating that it could be a year before a new administration is up and running. What do you make of those numbers?
That's an exaggeration. There may be some people who don't get appointed for until months from now, but the cabinet will be in place in terms of the appointees relatively quickly before the new year. And in fact, I would be, if the Florida Supreme Court rules adversely toward Gore this week, I think you could have some cabinet appointees next week. Certainly, the foreign policy team looks like it's in place. So, I think that's a little dire, and things will move move much more quicker than that. The problem with if I could go on a little bit, I don't mean to filibuster, even though talk about Congress and the President. The real delay comes in that if you're a cabinet, sub-cabinet, an important person in the administration, the forms that you fill out are really difficult. You have to have a complete financial statement, and for anybody in the business world, each conflict of interest has to be looked into. Even if you're in government, I'll give you an example. Mary Jo Bain, who was a commissioner of welfare in the state of New York, was appointed to a high-ranking HHS Health and Human Services position in the Clinton administration. Well, as commissioner of the state of New York, welfare office in New York, she was sued all the time by Medicaid patients who felt that Medicare patients who felt that they had been denied benefits. And so she actually had 500 pending lawsuits on her when she was appointed. You know, and none of them turned out to be anything more than just what I described, but, you know, the FBI or personnel had to look into each one to make sure, you know, one of them didn't happen to be, something that involved a financial conflict of interest. So there is an enormous amount of paperwork, and if there's any kind of question at all, then personnel people have to sit down and go through these forms with these people.
Here's one cool thing I've discovered in preparing for this conversation that surprised me. There are scholars who only study presidential transitions. What is it about the transition time that has made it more intriguing?
Actually, I would dispute that a little bit. I think there are probably a handful of people that have focused on the transition.
Yes, but I was surprised to even find they existed.
Well, it's an interesting question from a political science point of view because it's actually an area where a political scientist can have an impact in terms of making recommendations and people in government listen. Well, the first big book on this was by a scholar named Lauren Henry and produced a book for the Brookings Institution in around 1960. And that book actually had an impact on a law that was passed in 1963 to create a transition office. And transition resources. This is the $5 million that's sitting at the General Services Administration right now that mm-hmm. would go to the Bush or Gore camp once there's a president finalized. So most of what we do is political science. I'd like to tell you otherwise, but most of what we do doesn't have an impact on policy. You know, we study it and we explain it, but if somebody actually listens, it's something of a surprise. So there is an incentive to do this. The work that's going on right now is by a team at the Brookings Institution led by a very good political scientist named Paul Light. And actually, I was referring earlier to some forms that you have to fill out. If you mm-hmm. go to the website brook.edu, you can find this Presidential Transition Project, and you can see the forms. So if any of your listeners out there in Minnesota have illusions or delusions or aspirations to become a sub-cabinet member of the Bush or Gore administrations, they can take a look at these forums, and some of them will have second thoughts about it, about joining the administration after they see the questions they have to answer.
Well, we'd like, of course, to have their questions right now. That means your questions. We're talking to Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston, and we're talking to him about the transition of the next president. Now, whoever he is, he has a truncated transition time. Nearly a third of the usual time allotted for the transition is gone. What makes that transition so important? What are your questions about the eventual transition between the Clinton administration and the next president-elect? How do you think both the Bush and the Gore teams are handling the planning for their possible administrations? We'd like to take your questions, your calls, your insights. 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to return to our conversation with Jeffrey Berry. Now, talk for a minute. It sounds like what you're saying is that Congress is going to be a bigger problem than this truncated time. But outline why truncated time might still pose some challenges.
It poses some challenges because you're creating an organization from scratch. I mean, think of it this way. You've just been appointed the CEO of a new company. You leave your job on Friday. You walk over to the new company on Monday. You walk into the offices, and the only people there are the secretaries. And, you might look around and say, well, where is everybody? Well, that's pretty much what it is. So because presidents know that, they appoint a bunch of people to come with them. But that's essentially what you're doing. You're creating an organization from the ground up, and you have to create new work routines. And so the earlier you get started on that, the better. And you can get started on that before you take office on January 20th.
Talk for a minute also about the General Services Administration refusal to open up the transition offices to either side.
They're in a difficult position. They don't want to appear to be favoring either side. It's a very non-political agency. It's probably one of the dullest parts of the American government. And if we talk too much longer about it, we'll lose all your listeners out in Minnesota. So I think they're in a very difficult position. What the Clinton administration has done is to start to offer briefings and to more informally allow the Bush team to gain access to some of the information they need. And if and when Vice President Gore concedes, then the keys to the offices will be turned over immediately. And more importantly, the $5 million will be turned over. But there is a transition underway by the Bush team already.
Now, the Bush team also is raising private funds to help ease their transition because they don't have those federal dollars.
And that's not a great idea. I mean, who's giving that money?
Well, didn't the Clinton administration also have to raise private funds for their first transition?
Well, $5 million isn't a lot for a transition. You have to hire a bunch of people and pay their salaries to do the personnel selection. So that's not a lot of money. And there's a lot of travel and, phone calls and whatever. So it's what we ought to do is raise the amount of money given to transition teams, and not to be raised from private sources, because private money is interested money, and we ought to try and avoid that whenever we can.
We're going to go to Paul in Minneapolis. Paul, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if your guest can address the issue of cost incurred to essentially displace and replace 7,300 people for a four-year term, a cost to the general taxpayer. And I guess a backdrop to my question is I find it somewhat difficult to believe that we've got 7,300 people who are incompetent to the point that they all need to be replaced.
Well, they're not incompetent. They're not being replaced because they're incompetent. they're being replaced because if presidential elections should mean something in terms of public policy, if we want our votes to control or influence policies in government, we need to give the president some people who support his goals. The 7,300 people who are nominated by the president are less than 1% of the entire federal workforce. So we're not replacing very much of it, but what we are replacing are the policymakers at the very top, and I think that's appropriate. If we don't do that, then elections are less meaningful.
Let's go to Dylan. Dylan's calling us from Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to ask a question.
Yeah.
My question is, where do these 7,300 people come from, and related to that, from where do the policy decisions come? I'm just assuming that Bush doesn't have an opinion about everything that's going to have to be decided. Is this coming from previous Republican administrations? Is this coming from a lot of input from the Senate, both for the personnel and the policy?
That's a good question. People are nominated. People nominate themselves. You can go to the Bush or Gore websites and send your resume in. Nobody will look at it, but you can do that. Most of the people at the top level are, they come from, I think, two basic sources. One is that people who are important to the Republican or Democratic Party put their names forward. And secondly, that the transition team, the personnel team that's in place, is actively seeking the names of good people and good Republicans or good Democrats, but also smart, intelligent people who are experts in the policy area. So there's no one way of getting there, and there's lots of accidental routes of getting there, but somehow the government, the top positions are filled. The number 7,300 keeps being batted around. It's really more like 600 that are top policy, that are influential policy-making positions. Those are the ones that go before the Senate.
We were talking about the Clinton administration sort of informally giving a hand to the Bush people. If anyone would be sympathetic to the hardships of a transition, it would be someone in the Clinton administration. Why was their transition so widely criticized?
The Clinton administration?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it reflected...
what happened?
It reflected the inexperience and it reflect of President Clinton. This was somebody who was... had no Washington experience and was, I think, in a way, very arrogant in believing that he didn't need a whole lot of it. And that was reflected more than anything else in his selection of his chief of staff, who was Mac McLarty, who was a utility executive from Little Rock, who Clinton had known all his life. They went to grade school together. Clinton, in a sense, in nominating McLarty, was saying, I'm the chief of staff. I don't need a Washington insider. So I think that kind of attitude carried over more broadly into the personnel selection, and they made some bad nominations, and suffered for it. And I think it was a negative start to the administration.
So what
experience counts? Experience counts. I think that's one thing that was overlooked, and I think that was Bush's weakest area, and he addressed it partly in nominating Dick Cheney to be his vice president. But I think he's aware of that.
I was just going to say, so what problems did that transition cause? Because that will help us sort of look for clues in this transition, right?
Well, what it caused was people make first impression judgments, you know, the way you do when you meet somebody at a party.
Mm-hmm.
And the first impression we got of the Clinton administration was one that was of, you know, administration didn't quite have its act together. It was, you know, Zoe Baird and taking on gays in the military right away and some issues they didn't want to be, shouldn't have been dealing with. And their first legislative priority, which was an economic stimulus package, flopped. So they basically failed on every front early on. And again, I think it was inexperience and arrogance. And that those usually are not in, those are often not in short supply. If I mixed my English there.
Let's go to Drew in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello. I was just wondering if you happen to have any information about the Gore transition team or the Gore cabinet. I'll take it off air.
Thanks.
I don't, because they've been very reticent about moving forward in that area, and I think appropriately so. I think it would be seen as pretentious and inappropriate. And so to the degree to which they've done any planning, I think they've kept it under wraps. When he's asked directly, he says, yes, you know, we're thinking about these things, and I've thought about the cabinet. but they've not been any more specific than that, either in public or in leaking information to the press. I don't think there's a lot going on there.
Theodore Sorensen, he's the Harvard University professor. He was a special counsel to Kennedy. He said recently publicly that this is going to be one of the most difficult transitions in a long time. Is it really that bad?
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration in terms of the transition of people out of power taking over the government. The greater difficulties we were talking earlier is dealing with Congress, because what a president wants to do when he comes in is to put forward some popular policies, get the Congress to pass them, and create the image of efficacy and power. And I think that's going to be very, very difficult for the if it's Bush, it's going to be very difficult for Bush to do that. He doesn't have control of the Congress, even though nominally the Republicans are in charge. He does not have control of the Congress, and the Democrats are not eager to help him. The Democrats right now are going to be looking at 2002. One of the traditions, if not law-like behavior of the American electorate, mm-hmm. is that the party out of power of the White House gains seats in the off-year elections. That's almost always the case, not every year, but almost always the case. So the Democrats only have to gain a single Senate seat to unambiguously gain control of the Senate. They only have to gain four or five seats in the House, and those are not big gains. So, you know, from their point of view, why do you want to help the administration? So, you know, they want to make good public policy and be good public citizens, but, you know, politics is politics.
One thing that strikes me, I know that the Democrats made a suggestion for power sharing in Congress. Wouldn't that help the new administration's first 100 days if we had that show of bipartisanship or unity?
It's not going to be a show of bipartisanship. It's, in a sense, real politics.
Uh-huh.
Talking about the Senate, where
right. Seats
are divided 50-50. It would only have the most superficial air of bipartisanship. Mm. It simply reflects that the numbers are 50-50, and the problem for the Bush administration, it's unclear if anybody's in charge. So I think both the Democrat and Republican leadership of the Senate is in a very vulnerable position in terms of really speaking with the president and being able to speak on behalf of his party. It only takes one person to leave the reservation, and you no longer have half the Senate. So it's a very dicey situation.
We're going to go to Carrie in Minneapolis. Carrie, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Welcome. I hope you can hear me. I've got this really bad cold.
We can hear you just
fine. Good. Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm curious about is that, you know, since the vice president has a bunch of people who have presumably gone through this before, you know, they've been vetted to a fairly well, wouldn't that make it easy for him to just simply move offices? And also, I understand that the Bush, you know, senior administration made things very, very, very difficult for the Clintons when they came in. You know, they were still fighting, and they also made it very difficult for the Clinton, you know, initial nominees to get through. I mean, Janet Reno was the third choice, you know, because Republicans, you know, for justice, you know, for the Attorney General, because the Republicans kept shooting down every other person.
Okay, let's let Professor Barry.
Okay, I'll take the second question first. Yeah. I think the partisanship on the part of the Republicans in 1992 will be revisited upon them. I'd be shocked if there were not some nominees that were really grilled, and there are probably one or two that are shot down. So those memories live.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your first question, certainly a Gore transition will be much easier than a Bush transition because they're already power. Just Senior Bush's transition from the Reagan administration was fairly smooth. That said, the cabinet and most of the large portion of the sub-cabinet positions would be changed. Gore has a staff of his own, which is a small staff. He doesn't have the White House staff, and a lot of those people are ready to leave. And Gore, of course, would want to put his own stamp on government. So while it would be much easier in that he could have Clinton appointees stay on a month or two or 3 months to spread out his appointments, I think he would want to move to having a Gore administration and to distinguish himself from Clinton. So there's that imperative.
We're talking to Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. We're talking to him about the transition of the president-elect. Well, whoever he is, it's a truncated transition time. Nearly a third of it is already gone. What sort of impact do you think that will make? What questions do you have about the transition in general? What clues are you teasing out about a President Bush or a President Gore administration? It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Greta Cunningham, make a smooth transition to her. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
That's right. Good morning, Catherine. A judge in Tallahassee is hearing arguments this morning on a Democratic challenge to more than 15,000 absentee ballots in Seminole County, Florida. There's a similar challenge underway in another courtroom in the same building, affecting ballots in Martin County. In both cases, Democrats are claiming Republicans added identification numbers to application forms and were improperly allowed to remove the applications from the election supervisor's office. Republican lawyers in the Martin County case have asked the judge to dismiss the suit. A similar request was denied in the Seminole County case. Lawyers for Al Gore and George W. Bush must submit briefs to the Florida Supreme Court today in preparation for tomorrow's oral arguments. The court will hear Al Gore's appeal of a lower court ruling that threw out his objections to the state's election results. An American businessman has been found guilty of espionage in a court in Moscow. A lawyer for Edmund Pope says he was sentenced today to the maximum 20 years in prison for illegally obtaining classified blueprints for a torpedo. Two giant pandas are in the air and headed for their new home at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. They're being flown in from China on a specially modified Federal Express jet. The pandas will be on loan to the zoo for a minimum of 10 years. In regional news, bus drivers and custodians in the Robbinsdale School District are continuing to walk the picket line today. The workers went on strike at 6 o'clock this morning. Classes are canceled today, but school district officials say classes are expected to resume tomorrow. St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman wants to use his city's reserve funds to reduce household fuel bills this winter. Coleman says recent forecasts of gas and electricity price hikes of up to 50% this winter would allow St. Paul to use the money for a clear need. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for cloudy skies with light snow and flurries in northern and eastern Minnesota, mostly cloudy in the south and west. Highs today from 5 above in the north to around 20 in the southwest. At this hour, some light snow is falling in Rochester, a temperature of 12 above. Skies are cloudy in Duluth and 3 above. And in the Twin Cities, some light snow is falling, a temperature of 16 degrees. That's a look at the latest news.
Minnesota Public Radio is looking for the next generation of members, and we hope you'll become one. How do you do it? It's easy. Click and join online at minnesotapublicradio.org.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include the General Mills Foundation.
This is Robert Siegel. All Things Considered is more than a news program. We bring you stories about ideas, about the arts, about interesting people and developments in our lives that haven't made headlines, at least not yet. We bring you the stories of commentators, the insights of scholars, and the experiences of all sorts of Americans. And we start with the day's news. Tune in later today to NPR's All Things Considered.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. Remember not so long ago when we interviewed Ellen Gilchrist? She's that beloved author of short stories and novels. Well, guess what? You can have a chance to meet her. This Monday is our next Talking Volumes book club meeting. You remember that? That's our joint venture, our book club with the Star Tribune and the Loft Literary Center. Ellen Gilchrist is coming up from the Delta on this cold December day. She's going to be talking to us Monday night. Get in your seat at the Fitzgerald Theater at 6:45 p.m., and you'll have a chance to talk to Ellen Gilchrist, trade some questions with her, listen to her read, and talk about her life and work. Doesn't that sound like a great time? Well, make sure you make it. We have plenty of room at the Fitzgerald Theater. Again, it's this Monday, December 11th, 6:45 p.m. There's always lots of things going on at these Talking Volume book clubs, Talking Volumes book clubs, and we'd sure like to see you there.
Also want to tell you that a few minutes after 10, we'll be continuing our political discussion today. We'll be talking to Georgia Sorensen. She's a former White House aide and a political scientist who says that it isn't partisanship that got us into this mess. It was middle-of-the-road politics and centrist political campaigns. You might want to make sure you stick around for that conversation. Meanwhile, we're continuing our conversation with Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. We're talking about the presidential transition. It's the truncated transition is what it is already. A third of the time that normally would have been spent to crafting the next administration has been lost in the wrangling over chads and manual recounts. What sort of impact is that going to have? Well, you tell us, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Let's go to Chris in Minneapolis. Chris, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thanks. Sadly, it appears that the Bush dynasty is going to retake the office, and I was wondering what sort of an effect the son of a previous president or what sort of effect George being a son of a previous president will have, either negative or positive.
Okay, thanks.
I don't think it makes any difference at all. He's going to have to stand on his own 2 feet, just as Gore would have to stand on his own 2 feet from President Clinton. So, a few months into the office, we'll see him as the president and not as the pretender to the throne.
Let's go to Molly in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about the administration or the cabinet of George Bush in Texas. I don't know a lot about it because I've been following Gore more closely. And I'm just wondering what you predict for Bush's cabinet and what type of people he might choose for that. I know there were some pretty strong themes running through the Clinton administration, and I'm wondering if there are any themes in terms of the type or style of people that he will choose.
I think he's going to have a more diverse cabinet than previous Republican presidents who've tended toward white males. The Republicans are very conscious that they did miserably with people of color, particularly African Americans and Hispanics, non-Cuban Hispanics. So there will be Hispanics and blacks in the cabinet. I don't know how many, but it will be more than a token one, I would think. There'll be certainly some women. So I think you're going to see a very different kind of Republican cabinet in terms of demographics. In terms of policies, I think you'll see some diversity there, too. He's going to have to, I think, appoint somebody that is seen as a champion of the right, the conservative part of the party. But I think for the most part, he's going to pick people who he regards as respected and not as ideologues who are seen as sort of red meat in terms of, putting it to the Democrats or pleasing the conservative right. So I think, the tip-off with Colin Powell will be his first nominee, I think, is going to set the tone.
And, of course, when we're talking about a possible Bush administration, there's also been talk about Condoleezza Rice as his national security advisor.
Yes, he's meeting with her this morning, so I think that's just a matter of waiting for Gore to drop out.
Now, one thing that if you start looking at commentary about transitions, you realize one reason why they're important is that, in a sense, it's sort of a, I want to say, shadow administration. In other words, you make decisions, presidential decisions, before you have to give policy cues even before you're in the White House. I'm thinking of Clinton, who, before he went into the White House, had to make some policy statements about the Haitian boat people.
Well, I think the policy is wrapped up in the personnel selection. So it's probably not as critical in the appointment to head the Department of Transportation as it is to head the State Department or the Defense Department. But that'll be part of the conversations that Bush will have when he talks to nominees. He's going to meet with people before he appoints them, and he'll know about their policies from the vetting process, or their preferences from the vetting process before he meets with them. So they're not independent.
We are
broad brushstrokes in terms of policies. They're not going to hammer out bills to send before Congress.
We're talking to Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. We're talking about a truncated transition time, and we'd like to know what concerns you have about the transition into either possible presidential administration. Is there a cabinet that you'd like to see? What cues are you picking up already? Do you think it's a problem that they've already lost a third of their time? Now, there are some commentators who say that this is going to seriously harm the next administration, whoever is in the White House. Others, like our guest this morning, who are saying, no, it's quite possible to recover from this. How important do you think time is? How important do you think a transition is? It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I wanted to talk for a minute about there's some concern that's been raised that because there is this truncated transition time, because the next administration might be perceived as a little wobbly on its feet because it hasn't had enough time, that there will certainly be people in the world wanting to test this new administration, sort of poke it.
Yeah, that's a real interesting question because back in the battle days of the Cold War, that could happen. Khrushchev immediately tested John F. Kennedy in Berlin and produced a crisis that was very, very difficult for the United States to face. And you could see that now. There's no Soviet Union left, but there's certainly plenty of bad people in the world that would love to stick it in the eye of the American president, whether it happens in the Middle East or somewhere else. That's entirely possible, and you know that's certainly the area that we would look most closely in terms of emergencies and challenges to the president.
All right, now let's talk about another kind of warfare. You were talking earlier about how the Republicans made the appointees for that first Clinton administration. It was sort of rough sailing there. If people remember what happened to Zoe Baird or Kimba Wood, and you said, there's probably going to be some payback. How does this legal wrangling and the shortened transition time affect the candidates who come by the Bush possible transition office?
Well, that's a real issue. You really put your finger on something that's very, very important in transitions, in that some people say no when they're asked if they want to go before they want to become part of a Bush or a Gore administration or a Clinton administration, because the invasion of privacy is almost complete. I mean, you have to, in filling out your forms, you have to tell them every trip you took to overseas. Imagine a businessman who travels all the time, having to figure that out. You have to, absolutely every financial investment you have has to be detailed. Any embarrassing part of your past is going to come up, and it may come up publicly. That is, it will come up in your FBI background because they'll find it. So for very successful people, looking at jobs that are very demanding, having to move, possibly having a spouse who has a separate career and doesn't want to move to Washington, you look at the costs and benefits, and the answer may well be, you know, I think I'm going to stay where I am.
We're going to go to Mike in Rochester. Mike, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question was for non-essential, non-policy-making positions such as, say, the travel office. Can those people just be let go with the new administration, or do they need good cause to, like with the Clinton administration's travel agency troubles with the FBI?
There is a permanent White House staff, cooks, gardeners, policemen. The travel office is sort of in between that and, the political appointees are very clear who they change with. So, the administration's first priority is not figuring out whether the travel office works. Those people will be left in place for a while. I mean, they're dependent upon this permanent White House staff to show them, how to use the telephones and the copiers. So that staff will stay there in the short run, and some of it will stay there because it's a permanent staff, and they work well. And the administration, doesn't want to get involved in trying to replace the cooks. So that staff is very, very helpful.
No matter which candidate assumed the White House, Gore or Bush, how imperative would it be for them to have a diverse cabinet? And by that, I'm not talking about ethnicity or gender. I'm talking about a Republican president with Democrats on his cabinet and vice versa.
It's common for a president to put at least one member of the opposition party into his cabinet. President Kennedy put Robert McNamara as Secretary of Defense, Republican, and Douglas Dillon, a Wall Street Republican, in as Secretary of Treasury. And it was a signal that this young president, this Democrat, was interested in hearing from people that didn't necessarily support him in a campaign. And I think that had an important symbolic function. Since then, it's become sort of routine. And the question, only question is...
What Republican did Clinton appoint?
You got me there. I can't think of one offhand. But there were... William Cohen.
Okay.
As Secretary of Defense. So, and that's a pretty big position to turn over to the opposition party.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think there's any question that Bush is going to appoint a Democrat. The question is, how many does he appoint? I mean, they floated an idea leaked to the press that they're thinking of four or five. Problem with that is that you can might make the Democrats happy, but you can anger Republicans. And it's also a question of which Democrats are actually going to serve in the opponent's administration after this kind of election. There may be few Democrats who are really eager to serve with George Bush. The ones that I've heard mentioned are not ones that are going to really bring an air of bipartisanship.
Well, in fact, that was going to be my next question to you, is how much more imperative is it after this sort of election, and how much harder is it to get someone to cross party lines to serve?
They'll find somebody. It's not going to make a big difference, though.
Huh.
Because a couple months into the administration, what we're going to be focused on is the policies that are presented and not who's presenting them.
All right, let's go to Kevin in Brooklyn Park. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, Catherine. I'm on a cell phone, so I'm just going to throw this out and get off and listen.
Okay.
I had read somewhere a while back that the G.H.W. Bush administration had made things very difficult for the Clinton administration coming in the transition, and that there were literally boxes and boxes and pickup loads of shredded paper leaving the White House before the transition. I wonder if you'd comment on that and see if we expect anything like that going the other direction here.
That's an interesting question as to who the paperwork belongs to. Some of it belongs to individuals and some of it belongs to the government, and we're sort of at the mercy of the people who are working there now to make that decision. You can't go retrieve it after they mm-hmm. take it out of the White House in boxes. So, I think, you know, you're going to find some people in the administration who aren't terribly eager to help the Republicans. But I think people in government are professional. And I think the idea that there was this rough treatment of the Clintons by the Bush administration was exaggerated. I don't think that was a source of major problems in the Clinton administration.
You know, it's interesting when you look at how we do our transitions, and then you look across the ocean to Britain, where things can happen literally overnight.
Mm-hmm.
How did our transition time grow? I mean, how did this evolve?
The difference is that we have separation of powers and they don't. There's
mm-hmm.
no difference between the legislative and executive branches of government. They're one and the same. The party that controls the parliament controls the executive branch. And so that is the key in the difference between us and Britain. And there's also a shadow cabinet, official kind of opposition cabinet appointed by the party out of power, and that, I think, helps the transition as well. And a stronger tradition of a civil service there. And I don't know what percentage of their appointees are political, but my sense is that more of the government bureaucracy is controlled by civil servants. In terms of our transition, a change came with after, if memory serves, after the Depression, that because of the delay between Hoover and Roosevelt, that the inauguration was moved up. So the second stage was that as I mentioned earlier in the program, that there was a formal program created by statute to help with the transitions, and now that's grown into where you have some funds that are given to a transition office.
You know, I read that the Reagan transition was a particularly effective one, and part of that was because he began his transition planning even before he was done campaigning.
Well, that's a good idea, if you can do it. I hadn't heard that, and I am a little skeptical that it was that much more wonderful than other transitions. I think what Reagan did that was particularly effective was that he, and I give him personally credit for this, that he really focused the early part of the administration on two bills, a tax bill and a budget bill, and said, nothing else. This is where we're going. This is the only thing we're going to present to Congress. This is the only thing we're going to work on. That's a little bit different than the transition. The transition is about putting personnel and a wide variety of policies in place. What Reagan did that was good was setting priorities for the White House itself. And it was not well emulated by Bush, and it was not well emulated by Clinton. They, in theory, they tried to do it, but neither of them was nearly as effective as Ronald Reagan.
Now,
so it's a very dramatic difference between him and the people that followed him.
Why is there such an emphasis on the first 100 days and the importance of the transition to help make those first 100 days happen? Where did that phrase come from?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the phrase, the first 100 days, come from a period in 1933 when the country was in dire straits. And the Congress basically threw up its hands and said, Mr. President, tell us what you want to do. We'll do it. And that's, in effect, what happened. That he sent down legislation that overwhelming Democratic majorities rubber-stamped it and sent it on. So there was the most dramatic initial year of an administration in our history because of the emergency situation that we faced. Other presidents have talked about that first 100 days, but it's turned out to be more metaphorical than literal. And nobody has, I think, except Ronald Reagan, has been so effective in his first few months in office. And the reason why it's seen as an opportunity, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that the opposition is usually weakened and docile, or more docile than they usually are. The press is eager to write about the new administration, but not necessarily ready to go to the mat with investigative journalism on them. And the American public is, despite the partisanship we see in the Congress, the American public is not a terribly partisan population. And I think the calmness that with which we've taken this uncertainty over the past month is evidence of that. So that's why in that first 100 days, your popularity is high, the press is weak, their opposition is weak, or the press is docile and the opposition is weak. That's why that is a unique opportunity. Why we call it the honeymoon period, before while relations are good and before the fights over who has to clean the bathroom start.
All right. We're talking to Jeffrey Berry. He's a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. We're talking to him about the truncated transition. Whoever takes the White House has already lost a third of that transition time. What kind of impact did you see it making? 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Exactly how key is this transition time? Professor Berry is talking about how there's both personnel and policy that has to be shaped during this transition time. Which do you see happening in front of you? 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Bruce in Minneapolis. Bruce, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. Good to talk to you. One thing that occurs to me is that normally there's only one president going through this process.
Usually.
And here we have two separate teams going through the exact same process. In some sense, it strikes me there must be some limited pool of resources of high-level executives to fulfill these posts. Is there some sort of competition between the two camps to get the best candidates? And could it mean that the eventual president who wins the contest loses out on some good candidates who they otherwise could have gotten because they were taken by the other team?
I don't think so. That's an interesting question. And it's obviously a unique election in that sense. And we might hear from about some people that turn down Bush or Gore, whoever wins, because they'd earlier been contacted by the other team. But I don't, for the most part, Republicans appoint Republicans and Democrats appoint Democrats. So they're competing for some people who might be in the middle, academics who are not identified with either party. I don't think the Gore administration has really put out many feelers so far. So I think if they had an active transition team and an effort underway, then I think your question would be more on target in terms of some possible conflicts. But I don't think Gore's doing that.
Let's go to Tom in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Yes.
In Minnesota, Jesse Ventura's transition was really done by Tim Penny, and he did a fabulous job. And probably to the point where Jesse, his opinion ratings have been very high. He's got a radio show, now he's working for the XFL. Does Dick Cheney have some of these same skills federally, the same skills that Tim Penny would have had in Minnesota?
Tim Penny is a former congressman from Minnesota. You probably need somebody from Minnesota to talk about the transition in Minnesota, not somebody from Boston. But I can tell you that Cheney is, I think, very well qualified to head this. He was a White House chief of staff. He was head of the Defense Department. He was CEO of a major Fortune 500 company. So I can't think of anybody whose paper qualifications are better. He's very well respected in Washington. And I think in terms of somebody who thinks about administration and how you organize things, in addition to somebody who's a good Republican, it's probably about the best choice you could make.
Let's go to David in Little Falls. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. You've identified some reasons why a person who has a successful career might be reluctant to consider being included in administration, from their background being exposed to, you know, leaving a successful career, and the issue of their spouse having maybe another career elsewhere. Are there any measures kind of being taken in Washington to make it, you know, more appealing for someone to be in Washington? I don't know that it's necessarily a fun place to live, but
well, it is a fun place to live. I've lived there, and I can recommend it on that. But we're talking about people who are, you know, in their 50s or 60s and have established roots in wherever their community is, and the spouse issue is, you know, that doesn't need explanation here. That's obviously can be something very, very difficult. So I don't, you know, there's talk, to answer your question directly, there's talk about, you know, what you could do, and there was a lot of talk after the last transition about trying to simplify the process by which people are vetted and brought in and make that process easier. If you go to brook.edu and look at the forms you have to fill out, I can tell you, you'll come to my conclusion, which is it's no easier at all.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go through an FBI check. You have to detail all your financial transactions. You have to give a lot of personal information. And anything that is embarrassing of a significant nature is going to come out. And that's still the case.
Let's go to Doug in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. Mr. Berry, I'd like to ask you a question about, there are some 40 judgeships that have been waiting for confirmation, appointee nominations, that have not been confirmed. Some of them have been waiting up to over a year. Mm-hmm. They've been delayed by the Senate. And what now happens to those nominees, number one? And number two, can you tell us whether or not there's any historical precedent for so many judgeships to have been delayed, nominated by a president?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is partisanship, and the Republicans don't like Democratic judges, and so they're not in a hurry to appoint them. And this has been a constant war between the Clinton administration and the Senate Judiciary Committee and Senator Hatch, who is its chair. There's two other reasons, not one other reason. Other reason is that judgeships are their senatorial courtesy. Senators want to have an influence over who the judges are appointed in their states or in their districts. And so there's that individual kind of negotiation that goes back and forth. And if the Clinton administration has appointed somebody that senators don't like, if they feel their senatorial courtesy has been violated, that can slow things down. And then the third thing is that the judges have to go through the same vetting process as something analogous to the transition vetting process. If anything, probably worse, because we want our judges to be not only clean but squeaky clean. So it takes a long time for the FBI to do their check, and so there's a natural delay built into the process. So at this point, these nominations will die unless Gore miraculously becomes president.
All right, Jeffrey Berry, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Jeffrey Berry is a professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include the Bayport Foundation, which is supported by the Anderson Corporation, and the Honeywell Foundation, providing the benefits of control worldwide.
Dodging the wheels of the world.